1800, one out of every two Americans was 16 years of age or younger. The population mix, which incidentally is almost identical to that in many third world countries today. By 1900, the ratio changed to about one in three Americans, 35% of the American population was 16 years of age or younger. By 1985, the number had changed dramatically. Today, one in five Americans, some 22% of the population, is under the age of 17. Now, those who study these statistics explain this dramatic change in a number of ways. It has to do, of course, in part with, in recent years at least, a falling birth rate. It has to do, in part, with the ability of medicine in this century at least to radically diminish the dangers of childhood death. It has to do with a remarkable increase in life expectancy. Between 1900 and 1985, life expectancy in the United States increased by a dramatic 28 years, from 47 years to the present 75 years. And the life expectancy of those who were already in what's called age increased also dramatically. In 1950, someone who was 65 years of age could expect to live approximately another 12 years. In 1985, someone who was 65 years of age could expect to live, in terms of the actuarial tables, another 17 years. It's estimated that by the year 2000, someone who is 65 years of age will be able to think of living another 21 years. In 1950, 4% of our population was over 65. Today, 8% of the population is over 65 years of age. And by the year 2000, it's estimated that there will be over 12% of the population over 65. Obviously, America is becoming more and more gray. And the question is, does the graying of America necessarily imply the weakening of our country? Is the analogy an accurate one between what happens in national life and what happens in our private lives? Does age inevitably mean a weakening of strength and a weakening of one's capacities? And the answer, of course, is no. By our standards, Japan is a very old country. Its history goes back at least 1,000 years and probably more. But in terms of economic vitality, certainly one would call Japan a youthful country, full of zest, able to reach out and to conquer new worlds. And certainly the fact that Egypt or Iran or India, or the countries of Latin America, have a much younger population mix, that their population, half of it, is under the age of 17, does not mean that their future is necessarily brighter than our own. Because clearly, national well-being is, to a certain degree, independent of the age of the society, largely because, since the Industrial Revolution at least, the strength of a society does not depend upon brute physical strength, upon animal energy, upon the ability of masses of people to take up the long bow or the sword or the spear, or masses of young people to be able to bear the heavy burdens which a pre-industrial society imposed upon everyone. Today, it's a question of brains rather than of brawn. And the truth is that, at least to the present extension of age, the fact that we can now expect to live into our 50s and 60s and into our 70s even, is a plus for our society. Because the trained mind, trained skills do not diminish in the same curve as physical skills. One can hardly think of an Olympic athlete who's over his 20s. And yet I can remember that in his 76th year, the year of his death, Albert Einstein was still doing important work in in physics and in research. And so it is that the increase in longevity of our society actually gives us a longer opportunity to use our well-trained human resource. It can be a source of strength rather than of weakness. Indeed, those who deal with the graying of America and have thought a great deal about it inevitably end up being more concerned, interestingly, with childhood than with second childhood, with the way in which we are profligate with the talents of our youth rather than the ways in which we provide for our elderly. In part because it's very easy to conceive of programs and plans which can take care of the needs for care, institutional and emotional, for the elderly. All it takes are people and money. But it's not so easy to see how we're going to provide adequately for the training of the young. Certainly, America has not distinguished itself in terms of providing for the development of the talents of its young people. And the demographers are particularly concerned because the population mix of the youngest cohorts in our society is very different than the population mix of those whom we represent. Increasingly, those who are most able to provide, quote, the advantages of a home, the advantages of books, the advantages of careful education to the young, are not reproducing themselves. The birth rate in America among the so-called upper classes is something like 1.7, below the reproduction rate. Increasingly, the youngest age cohorts are composed of the children who come from homes which are culturally, socially, and financially deprived, from the poorest elements of our society, from the least educated elements of society, from the youngest elements of our society. Mothers who are in single-parent homes, who are teenage mothers, who are not able to provide either the encouragement or the advice or just the simple substance and sustenance which a child requires. And since today, a child who's born today has a life expectancy into the late 70s, a child who grows up into maturity as a semi-literate, unable to handle himself without any real sense of himself or herself, without the skills which are employable in that society, will be a ward of the society for a long, long period of time, taking rather than giving, and will be restless, frustrated, and therefore unsettling in terms of the common weal and the social order. We ought to be actually putting into our classrooms, into our schools, the best and the brightest. But ever since the generation that graduated to our classrooms, of teachers who graduated in our classroom during the Great Depression, the teachers whom we have been encouraging by the rewards that we offer to go into the classroom have not been taken largely from the best and the brightest. It's been traditional for the last 20, 30 years or so to say that the teachers who are come into the classrooms come primarily from the bottom quarter of classes graduating from colleges, from the third and fourth rate colleges of the country. And I heard an absolutely frightening statistic the other day, that the teachers who are leaving the school system through retirement tend to have had scholastic aptitude averages just a few points above the national average, but those who are entering the classrooms today as teachers for the first time have SAT averages 120 points below the national average in our country. And so increasingly we are, for a whole variety of social, political, poverty reasons, graduating into our adult population, age cohorts of those who are decreasingly high school graduates, that is minimally educated, the semi-literate, those who have been educated on the street rather than in school, those who come out of broken homes rather than out of stable homes, who have not therefore had the emotional encouragement to mature into self-confident human beings. And if we want to be concerned about the future of America, the problems lie not so much in the graying of America, but in the growing illiteracy, the growing lack of skills, the growing carelessness with which we are training up our young. If a child from the age of 6 to the age of 18 were to go every day to school, to miss no school at all because of illness or for any other reason. They would be out of school during that period more days than they are in school. And increasingly, our children, when they are finished with school, are returning to homes where there are no parents, where there is no real adult supervision and encouragement. And increasingly, they don't have someone in the home in which they can bounce off their questions and their ideas. And so we are facing a future which we know to be increasingly complex. We know that the market is going to require people of more competent skills than heretofore. That a willing spirit and a strong back will not guarantee employment in the next generation, doesn't guarantee employment today. And yet we are graduating from our schools, and many more are not graduating from our schools, into adulthood, or what we call adulthood, a generation which is unprepared for the very clear, known requirements of our society. If you want to have a sleepless night, worry not about the graying of America, but worry about the growing illiteracy and ignorance of our young and our own unwillingness to invest the time, the energy, the effort in providing adequately for them. Imagine, this is the year 1985. We're well into the age of space exploration, into the age of high tech. And in the great state of Texas, the teachers in the elementary and secondary schools are in uproar. Why? Because they will be required in 2 weeks to take an examination. What will that examination test? Simple literacy. Can they read? Can they write? Can they spell? And they're scared because many of them cannot adequately read and write and spell. Now, when we turn the coin and return to the question of the graying of America, we find some interesting changes have taken place. I wouldn't expect that in a rapidly changing age. And the most interesting change of all is that age, the boundaries of age, have begun to disappear. There's increasingly what the sociologists call a class that they define as the young old. Now, what do they mean? They mean that there are less 70-year-olds in wheelchairs than there are 70-year-olds on the tennis court. What do they mean? When my grandfather was 65, he suddenly decided that he couldn't appear outside the house without a cane. It was a sign of venerability. It was a sign of age. He was still straight-backed and spry, but he had to have that cane. He was psychologically, emotionally of age and was to be treated accordingly. And many who were raised as I was raised still find it difficult to call an elderly person, quotation marks, by their first name. My children's generation will call anyone by their first name. And the elderly no longer are affronted by this so-called impertinence. We tend to feel young, to act young longer. Now, to be sure, there are inevitable changes as people come of age. They begin to get bifocals and trifocals. They begin to get hearing aids. There are a few more aches and pains than there were before. But the last 70-year-old who complained to me about the fact he was having to carry a cane had broken his leg skiing. In a sense, his complaint was a statement about the young old. Now, the young old present new opportunities. They obviously represent an increase in energy and the vitality of the nation, but they present a problem, both for themselves and for the nation. For the nation, the problem they present is the problem of making place. At some point, we have to move over to allow young people their opportunity. You can see this most dramatically in our universities, particularly since the enrollments have begun to fall and there's less and less need for the universities to expand. Now, if professors are allowed to remain as teachers in their classroom doing research into their 60s, into their 70s, even into their 80s, and many are fully competent of doing so, what opportunity does a young person who has just graduated with his PhD in that field have of employment? And so there has been an effort in many professional areas to set up an arbitrary retirement age. And of course, the young old protest. I can do the job, they certainly can. And many are allowed to continue. But the society, in one way or another, has to devise a system to allow for opportunity for its young. We can't indefinitely delay their achieving competence, their being able to develop and use their skills, the skills in which we encourage them to be trained. Now, for the individual who is a young old, the problem is what to do. The problem is a problem of imagination. The problem is to think that he cannot or she cannot simply continue doing what has been done before. We think of 62 or 65 or 68 or 70 as a retirement age. But then what? Many who have come, who are now coming to this period of their lives, have emotionally and intellectually made no preparation for that transfer, for the changes which must take place. And so we have some, I'm afraid, in the society we know, a great number, who really carry towards retirement the idea that that they had as teenagers, that somehow leisure time is equated with summer camp. I'm going to retire and spend the winters in the South swimming and playing golf and relaxing and doing the same thing when I come north in the summers. And that's retirement, a permanent 12-month-a-year summer camp. And many are coming to this period of retirement of young age today have come through the greatest period of prosperity the world has allowed any nation in its history. And so many have the financial wherewithal to think of spending the money which permanent summer camp requires. But what they haven't thought of is the fact that they've all their lives, they've used their heads, they've used their minds. And swimming and golf are not known to be heavily taxing intellectual enterprises. They're fun, but that's another story. So what do? They begin to find that time weighs heavy on their hands. They begin to age with remarkable rapidity. And they find that instead of retirement providing the pleasure which they had anticipated and provided for in terms of finance, it fills their lives with emptiness, and to a certain degree with loneliness, and to a certain degree with, therefore, with real frustration and unhappiness. The young old have a challenge for which there is no model, for which they have not prepared themselves. How to develop, as they are through the years, interests, talents, hobbies, which they can develop, enlarge upon, when they reach the age when they must move over to make place. And that's a challenge of imagination, with ingenuity, with growth. The young old cannot allow themselves simply to retire. That period of life is as much a challenge, a demanding, exacting challenge as any other. Now, the society does not readily provide employment for the young old. And increasingly, our people are becoming retired at an earlier and earlier age. Three out of every four men who spend his life in the workforce is retired sometime between the age of 55 and 65, one quarter of that age group. There are 20, 30 years of being a young old. So what do? Well, many of those who leave the university faculty just finally move over to some other university faculty. And that's hardly making place. In the state of California, there's been a program designed to encourage faculty members who retire to go back into secondary schools to teach as master teachers their particular scientific or historical subject. And you know, it's interesting. You know who complains about it? Not the parents, not the students, but the teachers' union, because they claim they're taking the place of those, the job of those who might otherwise be gainfully employed. Unfortunately, over the last 50 or 60 years, more and more of what used to be a voluntary society, a voluntary area in the society, has been taken over by professionals. And so many areas where there could be hands-on support by competent adults for people who have problems and needs have been taken over by teachers, by social workers, by psychiatric counselors and the like, and they don't want anybody competing with them on a voluntary basis. It's not easy to find out how you're going to operate as a young, old, outside that system which our society has been so successful as, that is, the system of professional and business employment. But there are many ways that one can go. There are many civic responsibilities that one can undertake. I sometimes wonder at the eager young people who undertake so many of their civic responsibilities in the 30s and 40s when they're really, to a large degree, taking time from their home, from their children. And if we might not now, given the statistics, the actuarial statistics, be far wiser for them to delay some of this involvement in this activity until they reach a higher and higher age level. But be that as it may, beginning where we are now, there are books to be written, there is music to be composed, there are songs to be sung, there are hobbies to be pursued, there's volunteer work of many kinds to be undertaken, there's service activities of all kinds which await the doing, there's tutorial work of all kinds needed to supplement the desperately poor education so many of our young are receiving. There are all kinds of activities that can be undertaken and should be undertaken by the young old, and will be undertaken by them if only for their own personal well-being, for their own selfish reasons. The problem of the graying of America, I'm suggesting, is not simply a problem of providing enough custodial institutional care for the very, very old, the oldest old. It's a problem of beginning to conceive of age as a rather long continuum, 60 to 90, 65 to 95. It's changes with each of us. It changes with each decade. It's a longish period. And it's a period which, at least for a large part of it, can be one of the most fulfilling which we can possibly enjoy. The tasks, the competitive tasks of the earlier period are behind us. There is a pension, there is social security, there is a degree of financial security. But there needs to be imagination and effort placed by each and every one of the young old, even before they become to that stage, of what am I going to do, where am I going to do it, and how is it going to be done. Now, the problem which so many of us have fixed on when we come to the question of the aging or the graying of America is the problem of how to care for the oldest old, for those who can no longer care for themselves. And here, obviously, there's a problem of providing sufficient institutional care, care of sufficient quality. It's not quite simply a question of providing buildings and beds. It's a problem of providing care and support. And here, of course, we face one of the tragedies of our mobile and society with its nuclear families. At the very stage when loneliness becomes, when we begin to drown in loneliness, the very stage when we cannot be provided for emotionally simply by those who are paid to provide care, our families are elsewhere, and many of the aged are so inured with this idea that they must remain independent, that they cannot even receive the care that can be offered them. There's no more tragic problem that comes across my desk than the problem of the middle-aged children who are saying, I want mother to come into our homes. Listen how I say, I want mother, because that says something about the way men and women age. I want mother to come into our home. There's space, there's room, I have time. And she won't come. And she's living in a gilded cage. She's afraid to come to the door. What would happen if something suddenly happened to her at night? And mother comes in and says to me, I don't want to be a burden on my children. There's reality in what both say. And there's tragedy in their ability to come to some understanding. One of the problems, perhaps the problem, which the political scientists most fear as America becomes grayer, is the competition for dollars between the young and the old. They worry that the old will not vote for year-round education, for quality education, the taxes. They're worried that the young will not vote for the institutional care, for the maintenance of Social Security care and Medicare and the like, which the aged require. I'm convinced that a society such as ours, with the prosperity which we enjoy, can provide both quality education and quality care. And I'm convinced there's enough understanding in our society to vote those kinds of taxes, those kinds of needs. But I'm also convinced that the aged and those who are their supporters must begin to understand that this is a society of limits. That much can be done, but not everything. The New York Times had a story this week about a 60-year-old woman in New Jersey who had fallen into a coma from which was irreversible, according to the physicians. New Jersey has recently passed a law which says that the life support systems can be withdrawn, but only upon the agreement of four people, four parties, the family, two physicians, and an ombudsman appointed by the state and the hospital in which this person is in bed. In this case, the two doctors and the family were perfectly agreeable to the withdrawal of the life support systems, and in fact, it was known that the woman had spoken before her illness of her desire not to have dramatic measures taken if this should happen. The ombudsman refused. Why did he refuse? He refused, he said, reluctantly because the state law required that the doctor certify that this woman could not live for another year in her present condition. And medicine is not an absolute science. The two doctors could not certify with absolute conviction that this woman might not survive on the machinery for another year. It would require something on the order of $100,000 to maintain this comatose woman, this vegetable, for a year on this system. And as I read the article, I kept thinking to myself, you know, we could provide 10 full scholarships to some very special school for 10 deprived children for that year, for the cost of this care. What I'm suggesting is that the society, it is now estimates, spends 1% of our gross national product on the management and care of those who are in the very last year of their lives. And there has to be within that expenditure some degree of money which has been being spent purposely. This expenditure of $100,000, or whatever it will be, to keep this woman, quote, alive, is a worthless expenditure. At some point, we have to say the issue of the quality of life, the issue of a person's own attitude. Because the person is prepared to say, as the text I read to you this morning said, I have no pleasure in my days. They have no meaning for me. I want to be allowed to die. Why do we have cases, and we do now, of people who want to die, and the hospitals and the state refuses to allow them? Why do we spend money for the kind of medical research which will not allow people to survive, but only to remain longer and longer in protracted degrees of incapacity and indignity? At some point, all of us are going to have to think in far more sophisticated terms of what we mean when we say we revere, we reverence life. Must life be preserved at all cost and at all expense? Obviously, there are limits to what the society will spend for its social needs. At some point, the oldest old, or their advocates, and their families, are going to have to accept the simple truth that death is a natural part of life, not to be feared, that there are many things worse than death, that a mattress grave is not a living condition, And we're going to have to be willing to say we are not going to spend the same amount of money trying to preserve the non-life of somebody who is irreversibly in a coma as we would spend on a prenatal condition where there's some hope that we have a full life of many years ahead of us. That is, between the ultimate right of the oldest old to live on in their incapacity forever, and I suppose in some point that's going to be physically, medically possible, 120 years, the old biblical terms, between investment in that kind of condition and investment in the young, our society must invest in the young. Of that I am, when the choice comes down to that kind of choice, I would opt for the young every time. The graying of America reminds us then that changes have taken place in the process of aging. None of us can escape age. Age is God-ordained for those who are lucky enough to enjoy it. Age is a burden to those whose aging is a difficult and burdensome process. We have made aging a far more agreeable time for many. We cannot stave off death. We cannot stave off disability. We must provide adequate care. And that adequate care cannot simply be provided by the state. We've got to find ways in which families work out the problem so that they provide the emotional care, the personal attention. I don't care how well run an institution is. Unless there is somebody who cares about the patient, there will be times when the patient's cares are not being attended to. It's true of any institution, the best run. How much more so those who are poorly run. And more than just attention to detail, that the drugs be given, that the person be washed, that there be attention and conversation. It's the emotional care, the love, the support. Second childhood requires a parent just like first childhood does, except that the child is now the parent. And though there is nothing ennobling about age, our parents as they age not suddenly become saints. Many have become more difficult, more cantankerous, more whatever they were than they were before. We were naughty when we were children, and we were difficult when we were children, and they put up with us. And now that the shoe is on the other foot, we have to put up with them and love them regardless. Our children are our children, whatever they do, and our parents are our parents, whatever they become. But most of all, for those of us who are still independent, for the young old and those who someday will be young old, let's begin to think of this as a stage of life which requires the same degree of planning, the same degree of imagination, the same degree of determination as did our careers. Many go back to school, and it's a wonderful idea. But we need to counsel ourselves about being young old and to make plans and to make provisions that are not simply financial. I thought I would close this sermon with some kind of uplifting little midrash which would tell you all that being old is really a wonderful thing. It's not. And then I thought to myself that I'd end the sermon with a nice little bit of uplift which would tell you all that you're all going to be full of health and full of years, young old for the rest of your lives, and of course, I couldn't tell you that. So I'll simply end by saying that I hope that whatever your stage in life, you'll begin to think of the next stage with the same degree of concern and of attention to detail, to placing yourself properly, that you've invested in where you are now, and that you'll recognize that families are as important for those who have become our children as for those who are God's gift to us as children. Amen.